You're listening to Red Center, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
G'day and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour and I'm joined as always by Jason. How are you, Jason?
I'm very, very well, Mike. How are you?
I'm recovering from flu, actually. I had flu, recovering from flu.
Well,
but I'm feeling optimistic about the world in a post-Obama era.
Absolutely, I'm extremely... it feels like a new world, and we're down here at the bottom of it, so I'm not sure what it must feel like at the other end.
I think to a certain extent it's more a reaction to a new administration than anything else, but I got to say, if there was an indication of America's ability to bounce back and surprise the world, it's going from a Bush presidency to an Obama presidency.
Yeah, I'm glad to see the back end of that bloke.
But we're not here to discuss politics. What we are here to discuss is red stuff and camera stuff. And we're going to start, as we always do, with the news. But before we get to the news desk, give you a rundown of what's going on the show this week. We're going to be discussing and following up on our interview from last time. And this time, Jason, you're talking to Miller Tripods?
Yes, we're doing Miller this time, an Australian story. And it was fantastic. I got the whole factory tour and it was really great. Really, really very proud to... call them an Australian company.
And then after that, I'm going to be doing a technical discussion on the Autodesk white paper that was published and explaining some of the findings from that and some of the implications for post-production workflow. And then instead of a Red Room this week, we have listener mail, or rather email, because nobody actually sends mail anymore. I occasionally send mail. I think it's kind of an old-fashioned fun thing to do. Yeah, I quite enjoyed writing a letter. It takes me a long time to do it, but no spell checker and all. But,
wow. But with your hand?
With my hand, yeah. Handwriting.
Oh my god!
With this cross pen, which I love to death.
Beautiful.
But let's kick off the week with and we have a treat coming up at the airy end of the episode. If you want to keep listening, a surprise for what's coming up next week. But first, Jace, if you can kick us off with the news.
And now, the Red Center news.
And just very quickly, a shout out to Mark Jensen of New Media Gear podcast, a mate of mine, newmediagear.com, who recorded those lovely bumpers for us, the little intros to our little sections.
Did you get any feedback on our bumpers? I'd have got no feedback either way on our bumpers.
Did you put them in?
Yes.
Okay, good. Oh, look.
I had somebody asking how we played them in, but not actually discussing them themselves.
Okay. No, I've nothing.
So now, where are we in the world of red?
Well, last episode we talked about the rapidly increasing sort of red production schedule, 4,300 out to 4,700 bodies getting out there. Now, this episode, I really didn't expect the numbers to go up any further. I thought that like 4,700 was where they were up to in terms of delivering cameras. Now, it looks like today, at least I'm seeing 4,751 up to 5,325.
Now, I want to ask you about this because does that mean that there are actually... me dropping my pen. Does that mean that there are actually 5,000 cameras, or is it just that if you were in the queue, you've now been invited to buy? Because I think, from anecdotal evidence, that some cameras in much, much lowers are only being delivered now because someone said, hang on, I do want my camera, but not for a month.
Yeah, look, I think maybe part of this acceleration is maybe people dropping out. But I think, also there's been that kick in the pants a few months ago where Red just said, look, okay, just like, do you want them or not? Come on. So there's probably a lot of people who maybe have got their emails but maybe didn't have their money. And Red obviously, you know, honouring their place in the queue, saying, okay, fair enough, just come up with the money soon and we'll get them out there.
So if I've got reservation number 5,299, I get the phone call, but it doesn't necessarily mean there are 5,298 cameras out in the marketplace.
Well, I'll read a little quote here from John, Big John, who is obviously, I'm not sure his position. He's just, I guess he's obviously in charge of getting them out the door. As of November 3, 2008, the delivery schedule for the Red One has been accelerated. In just over a year, since August 31st of 2007, Red will have satisfied over 5,000 camera orders. We have had any number of circumstances conspire to push the delivery schedule back and have on numerous occasions had to ask for continued patience on the part of our customers. We are now in the home stretch and envision fulfillment of all back orders by the end of November next month. Thank you for your trust in us, your faith in the product, and your support of the Red Revolution. With your help and that continued support, Red has outsold all of its competitors combined in that short 15-month time frame, and the future is bright.
So now that's interesting. So firstly, he's saying that they've outsold all their competitors combined. Well, I'm not sure who they're referring to there, but obviously it's pretty easy if you're talking about people like Genesis, because there are only 75 Genesis in the world, and that's a couple of years in.
That's right, and I don't really think there would have been that many D20s, D21s, out the door.
No, not so much on the
No.
But by the same token, I mean, they're not talking about, say, which I aren't competitors, of course, but not talking about things like HVX200s, with which they ship, you know, 50,000 a month.
Absolutely.
But the other thing is, he does say fulfilled 5,000 orders. I just wonder how many actual. If we get a chance to talk to anyone from Red, I might actually ask them how many actual cameras they've shipped, as opposed to how many orders they've fulfilled.
In excellent broadcast
style. I'm not taking anything
style,
away, not, you mind you. I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, I'll jump to this next part of the quote here. In excellent broadcast style, you've led me into a beautiful segue into the next part. Reservation holders number 4751 to 5300. Yes, that is all current standing orders. Were contacted today with their second email. Shipping will begin this week and the order of payments received. Today is a milestone for Red. The end of an era. The delivery schedule for the Red One. Beating all odds. Meeting our target of fulfillment by year's end. During this next month, while meeting the schedule of delivering the final back order of Red Ones, we will simultaneously be bringing cameras back in for our upgrade program, which is currently underway. We ask for your patience, etc., etc. We will be first faced with the Herculean task of orchestrating thousands of cameras in and out of Red. I truly believe there's no other group as dedicated and as committed to excellence as our bomb squad, and they will not rest till the job is done. And of course, in amongst all of that, they are designing and now redesigning two other cameras, plus whatever else they got on their plate.
Yeah, I must say, I've had our Red redone, and we're very, very happy with it. But yeah, like, it obviously is a big support job on doing the stuff that they're doing. So, you know, shout out to them. I think it's great that they're doing it. I kind of got to admit, I don't know if you feel this way, I'm kind of going to miss it when there is no queue for Reds. When you can just go and buy one.
Yeah.
Does that not kind of somehow make you a little, like, sad?
I guess it'll always be a little bit of a queue, but yeah, I don't know. I guess it is. I mean, I guess, no, look.
I mean, there's no reason for there to be a queue. There's no queue when I go to buy other things.
There'll be, I think, you know, as of probably the next time we talk, there'll probably be another queue, and it'll be a bigger one.
Yes.
There'll always be a queue for something else, I'd say.
All right, well, moving on from the cameras, what's happening with the old Red flash drives?
Right. Just a question. Has anybody got one? Anyone spotted one in the wild? Anyone seen one that's actually been shipped? They're meant to have been shipped by the end of October. We are recording this November 5, November 6. And, I'm just interested to see if they're out there. So if you've got one, give us a buzz. Let us know. We'd like to hear about it. How's it going?
Now,
is it worth the money?
I guess the big goss is what's happening with Scarlett and Epic. And I got pitch slapped by somebody who pointed out that I actually should have shut you down on discussing rumours. And they said that's not fair, that I should actually let you do that. So I'm going to let you now talk about the latest in the Red Crack saga. That is, what's happening with the next set of cameras.
Well, yes, the next sort of phase in the Red saga will be that they have announced a date for... Another announcement, announced the date for the announcement, November 13.
So we're standing by to stand by.
Standing by to stand by. Hurry up and wait. They'll announce, I guess, details, possibly, I guess, the ordering method, specs, probably pictures on November 13, which we obviously, I'm personally dying to find out about, because you've already got a Red. My potential next camera, whatever it will be. I think finally I'm going to actually buy a camera. I've been sending money out the door for decades because there's never really been a camera that has answered all of what I want to do.
Do you think it's going to be an Epic or a Scarlett?
Well, it depends. Probably, it'd definitely be a Scarlett.
I want to buy like 8 Scarlets.
9. Whatever it is, one on. Okay,
right? But you understand, it's not that I don't want them to do Epic and Scarlett. It's just a modicum of, you know, when you're actually in production, we are talking about the announcement of the potential of releasing something down the line. This isn't like you actually get your hands on them. It's not even that you get to see an actual working one. It's just you get to hear them say what they intended on doing.
That's true.
I mean, I'm like as big a Red fan as the next guy, right? But, okay. Enough said. I'll be looking on the Reds White come the 13th. Now, yeah, there were some...
I'm sure this will be, you know, this could take forever and it may never eventuate, but I do hope to get some sort of funding for a feature I'm sort of in discussions with people about, in which case I will be probably pushing hell and high water to try and shoot it on a red and probably shoot it on a red eye buy. So it might be an epic. Anyway, look, I've just got a couple of quotes on this announcement about the announcement. I want to say that no one... This is from Jim. I want to say that no one has any idea how incredible this announcement will be. Call this hype, please. I am quite sure that this announcement will be called a scam. Should be a lot of fun to hear the reactions. I can't wait. Jared is buying extra server bandwidth. We will post specs and renders for people to email around. This makes the Red One announcement seem small by comparison. Come November 13, you will hear more than you've ever expected. Then you will have to wait again for delivery. The message will be more than you could have ever dreamed. Then the wait will be unbearable. I have to suffer the same fate as you. It is exciting beyond measure and frustrating beyond belief. We all want it now. The only good news is we know what you want. So at least you will be waiting for something worthwhile beyond your wildest dreams. If I'm wrong and let you down on what we present, you can turn away from Red User forever. If I'm right, please show patience because you will not see what we will show you from anyone else. I'm comfortable in saying that the most aggressive speculation will not even come close to what we will announce November 13. We fully expect over 1 million hits on Red.com on the 13th. If I'm not wrong,
it's
look on the
wrong speech, isn't it? Really, memorize this.
No, if I'm wrong, look on the good side. You'll finally be able to turn off your Red User addiction.
Okay.
So, along with that announcement came a few little pics. Nothing gobsmackingly amazing. A few little renders of what could be the rear of an Epic. Could be the rear of a. Back of a Scarlet. If you look at some of the older renders of Scarlet, where it had like the smart handle on it, this looks very similar in the ergonomics. It looks essentially like a Canon jog shuttle kind of a wheel with a sort of four-way joystick, and all these buttons marked A, B, C, D. Maybe that's for presets, I'm not sure, but it looks very interesting. It looks like you can basically reach all of that with one thumb, so it's definitely the rear panel of something. I believe it to be Epic. Now, the next sneak peek we got, which is a rather unusual little render, if you scroll down on your thing there, Mike, yep, okay, which is, well, according to the render, if you look on the red badge, it is the red badge, it is the badge of a Scarlet. Now, it's sort of orientated, I think it's sort of lying on its side, I think it should be rotated 90 degrees, and maybe it's the back bracket, a slide-on battery, and the holes in the bottom are where the plugs go in, I don't know, but anyway, it's fun.
You think the Scarlet's going to have interchangeable lenses now, don't you?
I do, yes. Okay. But, hey, you can say whatever you want at this stage, you know, you just go hell for leather, what the hey. Okay. So... look, regardless of what it is, I just think it's good on them for releasing these little renders just for a bit of fun to sort of keep the peeps happy. And there are some very ridiculous
skateboarding
people saying that this is not actually the rear of an Epic or a Scarlet. It's actually a render for the new skateboard park at the Las Vegas Red headquarters.
Yeah. Okay. So moving along.
You're moving me along.
And now, the Red Setter Gear Guide.
Oh, dear.
That's good. No, it's good. Anyway, so...
So, in gear, if I can switch to gear mode of news.
Yes.
Last week we discussed the fact that we got our 18 to 85, and we've been shooting with it for this last week, and I wanted to make some kind of review of our impression of the 18 to 85. It's a really nice lens. We, of course, had the 18 to 50, which you've heard me talk about before. We also have other lenses and stuff. This lens feels much more like an S4. It feels much more like a full-on professional pro-end lens, not least of which is it has actually markings now on, for example, focus. So as before, it would just have a little number saying 20 feet. Now it has 20 feet and a little actual incremental dash etched into the metalwork, which of course indicates exactly where you are, which is really good for a focus puller, but also indicates a level of precision in the engineering of this lens that we didn't see in the cheaper lens. Now, it's moved from $6,500 to $10,000, but I actually think this lens is comparable with something closer to maybe $90,000 or $100,000. I'm actually really impressed with this lens. There are a few things, though, that I want to point out as sort of gotchas, things that you should have need to pay attention to. The first one, and I think it's kind of interesting, is the complete absence of a bracket, Jase.
Yeah.
This is not a lens that you can afford to put on a PL mount without having a
bracket. Oh, no, definitely not. Definitely not. It's any mount. The trick for, one of the tricks for sort of guessing, you know, what should I mount this or not, is get your fingers almost like you're sort of turning a doorknob. Hold the PL mount. If you can't hold that lens with your fingers tightly, if you can't hold the lens physically with your hand,
you mean as if I was the PL mount?
Yes, exactly. If your fingers were not the PL mount, if you can't really hold it, which you could of course with the 18-50, then it shouldn't be unsupported, really.
Well, now the fact is that this,
which obviously there is brackets on the way. People are developing
screw holes.
No, of course that is
nice to have something on there to mount the bloody thing. I don't need them to provide the mount. I just need them to provide a point for the bracket of the mount to click onto or something.
It would have been great if some of the third-party people had got some brackets out the door by the time the Red had launched. I think there is, by the time the lens had launched, I think there is a couple out there. I mentioned them at the last episode, the companies. So, yeah, perhaps ping back to that episode to double-check the names and details. But there is definitely some stuff slowly coming out there. Yes, $10,000 and you can't actually bolt it on until you sort of get a wedge or a block or something is possibly annoying. But look, it's an amazing lens for the money. That's probably a small price to pay, really, for getting this, what looks like impressive optics for the price.
Yeah, now another thing that's just a small gotcha is the lens cap. So if you're getting one of these new lenses, be really careful with how you're picking it up. Now, the natural inclination is to pick it up, put your hand solidly underneath the larger end of the lens, the extended end of the non-PL mount. And the trouble is that if you did that, if you imagine opening your hand out fully and having the circle, which is the lens sitting, or the lens cap sitting in the palm of your hand, your actual middle of your hand can cause the lens cap to press up and touch the front of the glass element because the recess between the front of the actual metal housing of the Red lens and the glass is adequate. It's just not particularly deep. Now, why is this a problem? Well, it is actually something that on the weight of this lens means that you could start rubbing your front element of your lens. Now, anything on the front element like that is not going to appear as like a scratch on the film because it's going to be too out of focus. What it will appear as is a loss of contrast or a loss of accuracy, if you like, at the middle of your lens, right where you want to be looking. So if you were to hire this lens, you'd absolutely want to immediately throw away the lens cap and get a stiff, hard lens cap. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're replacing our lens cap. And I'm not criticizing Red. It's just, you know, the lens cap that comes with it is just flimsy plastic and should be replaced with a professional one.
That is the case with a lot of other lens companies too. I think the Angenot and some Cooks, I've seen some factory lens caps that really shouldn't have shipped.
It's not a problem with the smaller lens because A, it doesn't have the weight to bear.
No, that's right. And B, you don't have such a wide cap.
An element inside it that sort of stops it from coming down on itself. Some lenses, it just doesn't matter. Like, but if you were using this lens and you're certainly in a rental market, you want to replace the front element of it.
Yeah, look, a lot of the larger lenses, those front element comes a lot closer to the front. When you look at the 18-50, I think that, you know, obviously there's a little bit of distance from the front ring to where the front element's inside a little bit more. So, yeah, there is a couple of people. I know that Duclos lenses, D-U-C-L-O-S lenses, they do machine a lot of very hard, firm lens cap, aftermarket lens caps. I don't know whether they're doing a Red 18-85, but go and give them a ping and sort of see if they'll start
definitely
knocking one up.
Definitely
invest
in one of those, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
In terms of just optical quality, what I thought was really nice is the sort of maximum resolution in terms of the focus is pretty much where the maximum contrast is. So for those of you less comfortable with lenses, you really want them to be sharpest at the same point where it has the most contrast, because otherwise you're kind of hunting your focus because you're trying to focus in. And if you don't have this in the case of a particular lens, which isn't the case here. What happens is you go, well, is it sharper there or sharper there? And what you're writing between is the point where it's got the maximum contrast, the point where it's got maximum resolution, if those points aren't coincidental. Because resolution isn't the number one thing in terms of sharpness that you kind of perceive sharpness as. It's also heavily influenced by contrast. And contrast, you know, comes and goes as the lens focuses. So you want to have those accurately together, which in this case it is. It's really nice. I thought the sweet spot on it was about 5-6, but in talking to some mates at Red, they're reckoning that the sweet spot's closer to f4.
Okay.
But the whole lens is 2.9 right throughout the zoom. So
overall, it's nice, pretty nice, you know, sharp lens.
It's a nice sharp lens for a zoom. I mean, you'd expect a zoom not to be as fast as a prime.
Mm.
And I think this is a great lens. Not, you know, super light or anything. It's like a big, it's a lot heavier, I think, than most people think it is.
The yeah, pictures are kind of particularly compared to the 18-50. When you look at your little 18-50, it's probably, I don't know what, they're probably 8 inches long or something.
Yeah. Then, well, actually, interestingly, you mentioned 8 inches. That's exactly what the focus, close focus is on that 18-50, right in front of the lens, like about half an inch in front of the front part of the element. We're about 2 feet 3 inches on this 18-85 in terms of you can't get quite as close.
And it's a fairly long lens too. It's about a foot and a half or so long. It can't be how far from front element?
I'm going to say half a foot. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
It's 2.5 feet from the maybe it is a foot from the what I was going to say the film plane. But
anyway,
I mean,
it's very good. Plane. Very good minimum focus.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So it's good and it's a lot more solid in terms of its mechanism. Though I think if we put an automatic
follow focus,
like a Preston that sort of wound it from extreme to extreme, you'd be banging around a fair bit on that
sucker. The only little thing I think would be great, and I'm sure they'll sort of probably pop it into later ones, is it just on, it needs little felt stops or something internally. When you get to the limits of the zoom or the focus, there's this massive
stops whack, abruptly, doesn't it?
Very hard and very loud, hard stops inside the lens, which is unusual because particularly if you're doing it in the shot or you're doing it in situ, it actually makes a loud noise that would, you know, mics would pick up.
The rumor mill is that this one's made in Japan, whereas the 18-50 is made in the UK.
Right.
Just some negatives, if I can be critical for a second. I'm, as most people are, kind of disappointed that it doesn't have the iTech data. So this is a lens that will not support recording lens zoom information. So if you were to use this for visual effects work, you're not going to get the benefit of being able to get the zoom information. It's not built into the lens. It's not something that can be added. It's just simply not available for this lens. It's just, I checked that with Ted actually, and he just said, yep, that's it. It's just not just not in that model.
Sure, it's available in the camera, so I guess if you want iTex, you'll just have to rent or get Cook S4s, I guess. Cooks. What? Who else does the iTech? Because Arri's is a different. The Arri's is a different system data.
Yeah, there is a lens version. Data system. There is some other people other than Cook using the iTech. I can't see off the top of my head.
Yeah, somebody else is doing it.
But you know, it's my constant hope that this will all sort out for Red. Even though it's kind of in there now, it's not kind of not working yet fully. So we've had trouble getting it to. So we're not up to speed with iTech on even the normal 18-50 yet. But we're working on it.
Absolutely.
But yes, it's a good lens. There are some issues you've got to be really careful with back focus because while the PL mount on your Red camera is an incredibly good thing for being able to adjust back focus, you actually kind of, unless you've only got one lens, you don't want to have to adjust your back focus per lens. You want to adjust your back focus to get it right and then have it equal across all lenses. And in my case, I'm finding that the 18-50 is not the same as the 18-85. Now, the problem there is that what you would do if you were a lens specialist at a major rental house is you'd shimmy your, or put shims in your actual lens to compensate for the point, because in my case, I'd need to change it relative by about maybe even 5 mil. I'm going to stop there because I'm guessing my numbers now, but I do need to adjust it to pull it back a bit. And that's not something that I can easily do. I could adjust the camera, but then I'm going to be out of whack when I stick on the next lens, and I don't want to do that. I want to have to not worry in the field about swapping lenses.
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah, no. So, the back focus should be set, you know, for the camera and for the mount, and the lens needs to be collimated to the mount so that when they're put together and whatever lenses you change, there's no interchanging, of course.
Yeah.
No fiddles. So, yeah, you're going to have to send it back and get it collimated.
Actually, I was going to ask you about this because I was listening to this phenomenally interesting, bit of a rat hole, but I think it's worthwhile. I was listening to this phenomenally interesting podcast in the car from the DOP, well, actually there's two of them, but one of the DOPs from The Sopranos. It's part of the American Cinematographers podcast, and they don't do many of these. They do them like once every month or two. But he's got a two-part podcast discussing the end of... Well, it's all about The Sopranos, but he particularly focuses on the last episode of The Sopranos, the one that cut to black.
Right.
And I've got to say, in terms of if you like podcasts like this, this is a treat. This is like sitting down with an Eastern European DOP who really comes with that sensibility that you... You know, like we talk about DOPs, I think more than any... You can say that there's a style of Australian DOPs, there's a style of Eastern European DOPs, mm. style of American DOPs, and you really get a flavour for this. And his intellectualisation of the process, his articulation of their lens choices and stuff in this podcast is just fascinating to me.
Fantastic.
I was listening to it, and I was kind of wanting to ask you, because when I, prior to, like, go back a year or two, when I wasn't so in-depth with cameras, if I was wanting to get a particular look, I'd simply say to the DOP, I'd like to see his face. And then, you know, they would come up with the lens. But you've got the director hit, but you've also obviously got the camera background. I mean, you have to rent lenses. You can't just have every lens you can possibly want. So what do you kind of put in the... What's the Jason Wingrove ideal selection? Is it just primes and what primes?
Yeah,
and
probably just primes. And I would actually probably rather than... The more I find if I make decisions beforehand, I guess I don't want to really lock myself in too much. I'd prefer to... Because sometimes if you make a decision, things change and then you're sort of stitched up by that decision and then it's, you know, it's an hour to go and get more lenses. So I would probably get, depending on DOP's preference, I'd get the Cook S4s or the Ultra Primes. And,
but what actual...
But I would get from probably get a range from, like... 18 all the way through probably to about a 1.35, so basically I can just do every lens in that they make, probably between,
so we're talking like half a dozen lenses or more?
I guess that would probably be 18, then a 25, 35, 50, 75, 100, 1.35.
And 1.35 would kind of be the limit of where you'd go in terms of... Because you quite like that long lens.
I do a lot of stuff where I'd sort of shoot from... I guess I should probably pull my finger out and try a different style at some stage.
No, I'm not saying that.
I sort of more on the sort of school of observing, of the sort of the feeling of watching from a distance. I like to have a bit of foreground. You know, like if there's a conversation in a room, I kind of like watching through the doorways and observing. I feel like I'm not necessarily intruding on the action. But then what I've sort of... And then I watched... John Adams, which is fantastic. A lot of that dialogue is almost shot like on a 20mm lens.
Oh, 18. I interviewed them about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like shot like 3 feet in front of the actor's face. Yeah, but it has an incredible... It has an interesting... You think that that would make you conscious of the camera. You think that would make you conscious of the filmmaking process. But it actually almost puts you right, almost like a third person in the conversation.
Did I lend you John Adams?
Yes.
Because I think that is a brilliant show. And yes. If I hadn't lent it to you, I would... Felt remiss for not recommending
it. I'm still working my way through the discs, but that it is outstanding series, and it just looks gorgeous. It is outstanding looking and directed and acted a series. It is just beautiful, and from the point of view of that it is so natural, the light is so natural, and what is unusual that you're so used to that sort of period things being shot in, like, you know, these two characters have to have a conversation. Okay, they're wandering up this path of a, you know, stately home. Let's go back on a long lens and do one shot as they follow. So much of this is shot like, as you say, 18, 20 mil lenses, handheld, wandering, walking. It's very immediate. It's very sort of Band of Brothers, very...
See, now what's interesting in the Sopranos discussion, and it's Sarkoff... Sakharov?
Yep. Alec Sakharov.
Sakharov, sorry, thank you. I'm terrible, which is unforgivable. But anyway, his style, he actually discussed not moving the camera around a lot with Sopranos. And the reason I thought it was interesting, he said, and I love this hearing a DOP have an opinion, and it's not like they're post-rationalizing it. A lot of this comes out in pre-production, but he was saying, look, he read the script, the dialogue was so strong that he wanted to not distract from the dialogue by having the camera moving around a lot. And I was expecting, of course you would, right? They're going to reference Scorsese, which, you know, Scorsese's style is a bit different. They'd have hit The Godfather, blah, blah, blah. Mm. He was talking about referencing 2001, the end sequence of Kubrick's for the end scene in the diner.
Yes.
I mean, wow. That's just awesome.
Yeah. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, well, I love having DOPs that have an opinion at all. I think that's probably the most the striking point.
I got to interview Ross Emery for a thing we did on FX PhD, and we were discussing his role of DOP with visual effects supervisors. Because, as you know, in PhD this term, we've got all these senior visual effects supervisors, like, you know, top names, literally, like John Dykstra.
Right, and Ross has done a lot of effects intensive because he's done shows.
And I guess, sort of linking back to Red for a second, Ross actually shot initially with the film, obviously the film, he shot with 35mm film on things like Dark City, which miniatures, but then he did all three Matrix films, huge effects films, but that's all film. Superman now on the Genesis, where he discovered that if you ran the Genesis hot in the green screen, in other words, a stop or two over on the green screen, they were actually getting better, much better keys, something we found as well. And then, of course, he just shot The Knowing on Red. He has film, Genesis, and Red at feature film level with, you know, major Hollywood, because Nicolas Cage is in The Knowing. It's not out yet. The Knowing's coming out next year. But, man, it was just fascinating hearing his intellectualization of the process, but at a really, you know, being an Australian DOP, very down to earth, very just blunt, but it's like putting it all together in pre-production. I mean, literally putting it together in pre-production and then on set just trying to, you know, knock through what they've kind of worked out. I'm wondering, how long would you spend with a DOP talking about the sort of style of stuff before you shoot it? Because I sort of thought pre-production was an organizational thing. For me, it's always been that. It's more organization.
Yeah. But look, it's a little bit different to what I do with TVCs. In a way, it's sort of shorthand. We'll sort of, a lot of the time, obviously, this is analogous to a feature. The script will dictate the tone as well, you know, of what it should be. But to be honest, sometimes even on a TVC, we sometimes don't even talk about. I mean, we might talk about the, you know, what time of day it's meant to be, and you know. But in a way, TVCs are sometimes just so shallow that you don't even. I kind of like the DP to come up with this sort of stuff, and I'll sort of I don't know what I like. I don't know what I hate, but I'll tell you when I hate it, kind of thing. I like the DPs to. I don't necessarily want to tell them how it should look. I like to sort of have them bring stuff to the table. I think a lot of the times, DOPs or DPs forget. Some DPs forget what the initials stand for, and that is director of photography. That. You know, if I just want a robot to sort of do the lighting, I'll get a gaffer and I'll just do it myself. You want someone to bring something to the table, come up with the idea.
I mean, I know DOP as a lighting director, effectively.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You're talking, I guess, today more about the other half, which is the lens choice, camera movement type stuff.
Yeah, I guess I'll probably be able to tell you more about this after I do a film for a change. But I think
in that Sopranos discussion, he was even discussing in terms of lighting, making sure that they pretty much lit everything from above, in terms of no stands.
Yeah,
just because they wanted to free up the actors and the space and the dramatic pacing. And
absolutely, I mean, I think that's probably also come from the director not wanting restrictions. I did a spot a couple of months ago where I had sort of kids running around, and I really wanted to, from everyone's peace of mind, I got the DP to light everything from out through the windows. I don't want any stands, I don't want any lights inside. I just want to sort of light everything from the window, first of all, because kids aren't going to trip over stuff, but also just it actually looks real. You're essentially just replicating the way the natural light comes through the windows, the way it falls, and it's gonna look, you know, altogether more realistic. But also just psychologically, you don't want to sort of be wandering through this forest of cutters and lights and stands. I love, you know, the fact that really you're walking into, you know, you choose the location for how it looks before the crew arrives, and then just the lights outside are just to make it consistent.
I mean,
you know?
I'm so used to people shooting, not you, I'm not talking about you, but people just shooting commercials for coverage, right? You shoot the wides, knock in for the close-ups kind of events. And it really is. Now, what I found really interesting about the Sopranos discussion is about the last scene now, the one that cut to black. So a couple of points that he made. I'm going to get this wrong, but you should listen to the podcast, and we'll have the link in the show notes. He used for only one of three times or something in the series a POV shot from Tony Soprano's point of view.
Right.
He had every shot pretty much locked off except for one, which was a traveling shot, which moved with the guy with the member's jacket because he was trying to set up that maybe this character was more important to add suspense, even though it didn't go anywhere, but then he was heading to the men's room. Is that a reference to, you know, when in The Godfather, he had to do his first, you know, Pacino had to go into the bathroom, get the gun for the first time.
Yeah.
Was that where the gun was hidden? The fact that he gave extra emphasis to this character by moving the camera. This is not shooting for coverage, right? This is
is shooting for emotion and shooting for story and for...
And he crossed the line. He deliberately crossed the line in the shots because he wanted to be disorientatingly, slightly off-key kind of thing. And there's a whole thing with Meadow trying to park the car outside, adding...
I'll
but that's in the script, right? But this is like DOP adding to stuff, and it's not shooting for coverage. Obviously, he shoots as much coverage as you want on the final scene at Sopranos.
And it's interesting that those kinds of decisions, theoretically, come from the camera side rather than the director. A lot of the times, particularly on a show like this where the schedule has got to be hell, I've got so much respect for these guys that can crank out so many minutes a day, that it does have to come down to that the DOP does start to have then be the director of the photography, and thus in some way director of the editing, that he's coming up with information that's not just that light goes here and put a 75mm lens on. I think that's fantastic.
We should pick up on this conversation next time, because there's some other stuff I want to discuss with you about this, which is actually another podcast that I'll bring up next week, and it's to do with that idea of collaboration and also that idea of, you know, how you work with people and what you bring to the table. Because you're right. Like, I mean, I'd never thought of it in terms of him doing the editing, but he's dictating the editing. I should just point out, though, as he says quite clearly in that podcast, there are actually two DOPs on the series.
Sure.
He's did the pilot and the final one, but he did about half the series.
Oh, look, I think that's... I just love when DPs, when they sort of come up with that sort of stuff and start to talk about camera movement. There's this fantastic... and I guess I've got most of this from the fantastic commentary on Castaway. They talk about the psychology of the camera movement on that film, which is brilliant. Like, if you watch the first part and you've got all when Tom Hanks is in FedEx mode and everything is about time, everything is about movement and schedules, it's everything is almost done like in one shot. Steadicam moves, it's bang 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 following him around, it's all activity and the camera never stops moving. And then the moment he hits the island, the camera stops. There's no cranes, there's no dollies, nothing. They basically wanted the cameras to almost be like closed-circuit television. The cameras basically might have the little pans, but essentially it's just like the camera plonks. It's plonked down on the tripod, and Tom enters, does his stuff, and exits. It's very, very different. You also notice, and you only notice it when the music returns, but there is no music, there's nothing. It's a whole psychological shift, and so much of that is the camera. And then when he comes back off the island again, then everything returns back to sort of normality.
So that's Zemeckis, and it was Don Burgess who did
Don Burgess, who did Forrest Gump as well with Bob.
Yeah, also did Terminator 3, I think.
Yes, may have done.
I think he did.
I was thinking of T2. Yeah.
T2, but, no, T3,
no,
yes.
No, he didn't. The psychology of camera movement is fantastic, and it's great to have that collaborator coming up with stuff like that with you, because, again, sometimes you are dealing with so many other things, the schedule, actors, performances, dialogue, lines, and it is great to sort of split that job of directing. It's essentially the other half of directing, really, talking about the way the camera moves.
No, totally. And when it can underline the and so intimately underline what's going on in terms of the story arc and the writing and the narrative, I mean, wow.
Mm.
Well, we should swing back to our speaking of moving cameras, our interview for this week, which is our Miller interview on tripods. Now, if you remember, we were having a discussion about tripods, and I wanted a lightweight camera for our Red, and so I initially bought a Miller as our first tripod, and I wanted a lightweight one because we were flying with it and stuff, and I didn't want to have to lug around a huge thing. You looked at my Miller, initially thought it was a bit, you know, not a toy, but you definitely were a bit like, well, the bowl isn't big enough and blah, blah, but then you played with it and you actually quite liked
it. Yeah, look, actually putting the camera on it, I mean, again, you don't want to sort of put massive bits of gear and all on this stuff. It is designed to be a lightweight camera for a lot, you know, to put lightweight gear on it. But yeah, look, that is the Arrow 55, which we'll discuss in length when we get to the interview with Greg Neal, who's the sales manager from Miller Support. And we sort of basically go through the range. One thing that they do specialize in, and this is their they would readily admit this is their foray, is the run and gun, lightweight doco, like two guys with backpacks down the Amazon kind of filmmaking. And that's where they really excel their stuff.
A friend of mine, Peter Coleman, who you're going to have dinner with on Saturday night, is used a Miller in Antarctica, and he's featured in their ads in American Cinematographer. And yeah, that's exactly what he was saying. What lightweight needed to work literally in the blizzards. And Peter is a doco maker who's done IMAX documentaries and stuff, though this particular one wasn't.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he used Miller.
And one, I think one of the other interesting things was just popping into momentary pro-Australianism for a minute, but what they do, and what I was surprised at, before I did the interview, I got the fantastic factory tour, and it was really great.
A T-shirt and a goodie bag and a...
I did. I got a little mini tripod. And
oh, really?
Thing. Yeah,
fantastic.
It's a cute little thing. It's wonderful. But it was amazing to see that they virtually make everything there in Naartam, and half an hour down the road, everything. They've tried bringing in stuff from overseas and getting stuff manufactured in China, but they are not happy with the tolerances. They just can't do things to the level of to the exacting tolerances that they require. Even machining their own screws, a lot of this stuff is all made in-house. Yeah, they're sort of making a lot of their fasteners. So you would really think that I was staggered to find that they actually made them there. I got the full tour from go to woe. And one of the wonderful things, and I do touch it on the podcast, so I won't say much more, but what's fantastic is probably 90% of the people that work there now have been working there for 15, 20 years. And the guy who probably built and was the last person to check your Miller tripod out the door 15 years ago is the same guy who's going to do it today. That was probably my biggest takeout from the whole thing, was that really, you know, quality and workmanship and pride of place, I guess. So yeah, no, it's a great interview.
Nice people too.
Yeah, no, lovely people.
If you're ever at NAB, they always go drop by the booth, and they're nice people.
Yep, no, they're really great. So here's Greg Neal, sales manager from Miller. Well, I'm here today at Miller's showroom, and indeed their factory here in Sydney. I'm speaking to Greg Neal, who's the general manager of Miller.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing, Jason?
Thanks for taking the time to speak today. So I've just had a fantastic tour of the factory. That was the first thing I was amazed at, that there is a factory here.
That's right. And I mean, I think it's a wonderful story, in terms of, a manufacturing company. We've been operating now for more than 50 years here in Australia. We've been in this current location in Taman for more than 30 years. It's a family-owned business. One of the things that always gives me a buzz is in the Powerhouse Museum, you'll still see an original Miller fluid head, and we still list in the top 100 Australian inventions, so that's something that we're particularly proud of. The technology that's used in the heads today is poles apart from the technology that was used in those days, which truly was a fluid bath. Today, it's a very highly technical product with a lot of mechanical mechanisms happening inside to give you that variable drag selection ability and also the repeatability of that. If you look inside one of our heads, it for all intentional purposes looks like looking inside the gearbox of a motor car.
I think there's obviously horses for courses, and I thought we'd sort of go through the range and you can tell us what suits what kind of work.
That sounds like a great idea, Jason, and I think that there is a lot more to selecting the correct camera support system than perhaps people first realise. And also you need to break it out into elements. It isn't just a question of buying a head and a tripod. You need to look at your specific applications and then decide what's the preferred head and then the preferred legs to go with that head to get the right match for the type of work that you'll want to be doing with it.
So I guess we should probably sort of start looking at the different ranges here, and you can tell us what you've got to offer.
Firstly, in terms of, head, tripod combinations, there are two primary size ranges that we look at, which is related to the actual bowl size of the fluid head. It's either 100 millimetre or 150 millimetre. And the RED camera has applications on both 100 and 150-millimeter systems. One thing that, in terms of sort of talking about 100-millimeter and 150-millimeter bowl sizes, it's fair to say that within the film industry, the standard is 150-millimeter bowl. And the reason for that is that traditionally the heads required to support the film cameras have had to be of a very high capacity, and to accommodate all the necessary counterbalance systems and whatever, you know, the bowl size had to also be large to take the mass of the head, and thus it was a 150mm bowl size. Today, with the compactness that's coming with a lot of the higher performance cameras, film, and of course digital formats, and ideally the RED, 100mm systems are now a very viable option.
So what should people look for when, I mean, it sounds like a very simplistic question, but I'm sure there's a lot to it, really. What people should be looking for when they're choosing a head to make sure they don't buy something that's not up to the job?
Okay, well, I think the first question we always ask a customer is, can you provide us with a reasonably clear idea of the actual total weight of the camera and accessories that you're going to be wanting to place on top of the head? And that even that question doesn't give you a definitive answer, because we spec heads out, as do other manufacturers, with specified minimum and maximum payloads. And whilst we might indicate that it's a 20-kilogram payload, you also have to take into account the way that mass is applied to the camera and the relevant center of gravity that occurs within that mass. So a lot of heavier accessories that are mounted up higher will in fact create a payload effect, which is greater than the actual net weight of the unit. So whilst the unit might only weigh 15 kilos, the actual mass with center of gravity high could equate to 25 kilos, so a 20-kilo head is not going to be satisfactory. And I think it's always prudent to err on the side of capacity, so that if you're looking at something that does in fact have a net payload near the manufacturer's recommended maximum, then you're probably going to be pushing the limit, because things are going to change. You'll probably have other accessories in the future. You might want to add additional batteries, all that sort of thing. So you should always err on the side of having up capacity in payload.
Well, I guess if we sort of split it up in the different sort of categories of work, I suppose the sort of lightest package you'd have would be a guy with a RED one and maybe a Nikon lens, and he really wants to be able to just hike up a mountain and shoot some time lapse. A one-person crew or a two-person crew?
The system that we'd offer, and in fact I know is in regular use with a number of RED One users that are actually doing specifically that activity, would be our Arrow 55 system, if you like, or our Arrow 55 head, which is a 100mm system with a capacity of around about 20 kilograms, and it has a number of nice features, including 7 positions of pan and drag selection. And it has a nice range of counterbalance selections that allows you to operate up to that 20 kilo maximum payload.
And a little feature which is not always found on the smaller heads is I love like the little light up bubbles.
That's right. We know that our clients are often in awkward locations, so we do provide an illumination for the drag and pan selection, as well as the bubble level.
The head is just part of that story. At that end of the equation, you really want some options in the legs.
There's actually a lot of options. You've got the choice of aluminium or carbon fibre. You will pay a premium for carbon fibre. The benefit is it's lighter. I guess the benefit with aluminium is that maybe there's a little bit more robustness or durability with an aluminium leg if it was to sustain some damage.
Right, and I guess you call them the solo legs is the other option for a 100mm bowl, which I just think are fantastic. That's really more something out of the high-end stills photography book, a very simple single leg, and like if you imagine any sort of stills tripod, that it's sectioned and all the legs are individual and not tied together with spreaders. If you're hiking up a mountain, and I think that'd be the way to go.
Most definitely. And again, in terms of the right product for the right application, on the solo 100mm tripod, maximum height is 1.9 metres and minimum height is a mere 220 millimetres. If we go to a more conventional style of tripod, i.e. our HD series in two-stage, maximum height 1.6 metres and the minimum height is 480 millimetres.
And then obviously if you want to get lower than that, you guys make a hi-hat.
Yes. I mean, one of the nice things about the Solo, if you have it on board, is it replaces a hi-hat, and that's why a lot of people will take it, because it just gives them so much more versatility. The fact it doesn't have a spreader does compromise the tripod's stability, so it's not a tripod that we'd initially advocate as being the complete choice for a RED user, but we do see a lot of RED users adding this particular tripod to their kit to take on specific applications because of constraints of weight, access, and I guess any other thing that would sort of come to mind. In the conventional style of tripod, which comes with a mid-mount spreader and also available with a ground spreader, single and two-stage. Just to clarify that, single stage means one lock per leg, and two-stage means two locks per leg. You're not counting the number of sections, you're actually just counting the number of locks. Within the 150mm range, we offer a very, very nice product, and it's very, very, very well priced in terms of that 150mm market. In fact, it's probably the most economically available 150mm head on the market. It has a payload range up to or in the order of 30 kilos. It offers four positions of drag in pan and tilt, and four positions of counterbalance on across that payload range.
That's about 65 pounds or 30 kilos. That's a well-laden red one with big zoom and matte box and all that sort of stuff.
That's right. I think, as I say, I really want to reinforce that you should err on the side of upside in terms of payload capacity. But the other advantage of, say, a 100mm system is it will be more compact. It'll make it lighter. It'll make it more easily transportable. So, again, that may be a big consideration in terms of your choice.
Okay, and what are the leg options for a 150mm bowl?
Well, in fact, they're identical to the 100mm bowl. They come in single and two-stage, carbon fibre and aluminium, mid-level and ground spreader, and the height range that I mentioned previously is the same as well. So it's really a larger bowl size to accommodate a larger head with a larger capacity of payload.
So what's next for Miller?
First of all, we're very, very excited about this whole red evolution. I mean, this is one of the biggest things I've certainly seen in the industry in terms of momentum with so many new users coming on board. So we're working towards at a new product, which will be a 150mm system, to really look at better catering for red users.
Fantastic. That's about all you can say at the moment.
But I am hoping that we will be demonstrating that product midway through next year, you know, and it will be available hopefully not too long after that.
And some new stuff to come out for NAB 09.
We're bringing out a new compact head, you know, with that EX3 format really gaining momentum, or the EX3 model from Sony. We'll be bringing out a high-performance 75mm head at NAB next year.
So what do you think is Miller's edge over the competition?
Well, that's a great question, and thank you. And I think that's why I have such an affinity towards red users, because we really are a slightly smaller fish in a bigger sea in terms of being a tripod manufacturer. But we're very, very, very connected to our customers. We're very focused on providing products that meet the needs of specific users in the market. It's that connection to our customers and that synergy that we see with Red that really has us very excited.
That's great. Thanks for your time, Greg. It's been fantastic. Great to get the tour. As I say, I was blown away that you actually made stuff in the country. I think so much of the stuff now is imported and sort of knockoffs and reverse engineered equipment. We're so used to it now. Great to see something built from the ground up here. Go Aussies.
Absolutely. And thanks for those comments, Jason, because obviously that's very much something we're very proud of.
Terrific. Thanks, mate.
Well, now, moving from production stuff to technical stuff, Jason, I want to have a bit of a chat about this Autodesk white paper that came out. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, but we actually provided a whole lot of images or footage to the guys at Autodesk back months ago, actually. There's a couple of points that I want to discuss from the white paper, but I wanted to make a general point first and foremost, which is to do with the R3D use across the industry. Now, you're seeing some people coming out with R3D support, as we've discussed, and we want to continue on this bent. But what's kind of interesting is that the Linux version is not out, only the Windows version of the...
Right.
And that makes a big difference. There's a lot of companies that are, like Autodesk, that have a lot of their production line stuff in Linux world.
Yeah.
And so they're all geared up, ready to go, but they really want the API and all the stuff. So they're looking at it in Windows, checking stuff out, solving Bayer patterns and stuff, but all good, just need the Linux version. So when that happens, you'll see a massive break in the amount of applications that come out. So
okay.
While they've said that the R3D API stuff is out, it's not out for Linux yet, and that actually holds out a bunch of the colorist companies as well as others. But
so they can do some progress
totally.
In the meantime.
And they're consigned deals, but they just can't release products. They don't have API stuff supporting Linux. Now, anyway, Autodesk has released this white paper, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And it's a good read. Most of it, almost half of it, I'm sure many of you will understand well, because it kind of covers familiar ground. What I'm not going to cover is their workflow stuff, because they get into exporting XML lists for Smoke and Luster as well as Flame. That's interesting stuff. And I think the more interesting stuff actually is up in the appendix. If you go right to the end of the document to Section D, they have a section discussing red color processing. And this is one of the areas that I think is most interesting. Though if you first glance at it, you might like shudder and turn the page because this looks like a bunch of complicated graphs. And I thought I'd just
Like ants, actually.
Just explain what it is that we're looking at. Ants. So look,
ants going uphill.
This is some of the most helpful stuff that's been published in terms of a red workflow for feature film when you want to go to a traditional Cineon pipeline. So let me just explain a couple of things. Firstly, if you wanted to go, and I've said this before, from a traditional red setup to a non-traditional red setup, or maybe I should put it the other way around, from a red setup to a traditional post setup that uses whatever you want for doing commercials, there's really no reason to go to log. You can go to log if you want, no reason to go to log. But if you do go to log, and the only reason you go into log is just because you felt like it, and you're actually going to output on TV, then whatever you grade is what you see. Whatever you see is what you like. You're happy, it goes out. I mean, it's that kind of simple, right? Like, you could start with red log, and if you can grade it, Jason, to look nice, and you're happy with it, well, great. Yeah. It looks good, and be happy. But what becomes significant is when you want to start filtering it into a film pipeline. And here it's become a bit tricky, because what people really wanted, and I guess not unexpectedly, wanted, was just to have a button that said, give me effectively the same as a Cineon file. And that never existed. We started with Redlog, which certainly wasn't Cineon-like, and then they came out with two other similar to Cineon-type things, which was 685 and 965. Now, these are numbers derived from the point at which the LUTs got cut off in the 10-bit value range. And that was a completely sensible, normal thing. If you had a 10-bit pixel value range and you looked at the graphs, actually look at figure 4 on the graph, you can actually see that the bottom one cuts off at about, 685. And if you look at the top one, it cuts off at around 965. So that's where those two numbers were derived from. It's no surprise there. The question, though, is what of those should I use? Well, the top, there are four diagrams here. I'll just walk you through the four of them because they really make a lot of sense once you get a little bit of insight. The first one, you can kind of ignore it, just basically says this is what we measured. But when they subtracted a neutral black from it, in other words, when they just calibrated it effectively, what you get in the second diagram is a linear line that just proves that the sensor is linear. Now, what's confusing is that it's on a log diagram. Why is it linear on a log? Well, the bottom's log and the top is log. In other words, the x and the y axis are both log scales, and it's just a linear transfer function between the two. Okay, enough said, we know that it's linear. Now, the real fun happens in what's called section figure 4, which is about it's figure 4 and figure 5. But figure 4, the second last page of the document, this is where you get some really insightful stuff from what they've done at testing at Autodesk. They've said is that if you draw a linear line through the what you would expect from a Cineon file, which is that straight black line in that diagram if you're looking at it, if you were to try and work out which of the curves to use, most people have used 685, because 685 was kind of close, and you can actually see on their mapping that it is kind of close. It's not actually the optimum, though, and I've been suggesting that people should use red log if they can do their own inverse logs. But if they were trying to work in a Cineon methodology, probably their best thing was 685, but don't get too excited, guys, because it isn't exactly right. Well, what the guys at Autodesk discovered is that if you take the 985, almost the orphan child amongst all the logarithmic outputs that no one's really using, and then drop the exposure 2 points, you get something that doggone nearly is exactly what you want. And so if you were trying to take some files out of red over to Nuke, to Shake, to Luster, and you wanted to use some standard Cineon lookup tables, which is to say you're being a bit slack, because really you should calibrate your system properly. But let's say, you know, you're just sitting out there and you've got nothing else to go on, then taking the 985 output and dropping it to stops in exposure, or setting exposure down to -2, will give you almost near as damn it what you'd expect from a Cineon film scanner or like an ARRI laser scanner. And so that means that if you have somebody that says, look, I want to grade your footage and pretend like it's DPX files, give me DPX files, then you should say to someone, great, just transfer my footage, log 985, drop the exposure to -2, and now when I look at that, in an environment that has viewing LUTs, in other words, has the mechanism to view log files in a linear world just for the purposes of grading, but will not touch the underlying files that will then wander through to a film recorder, I will get pretty much exactly what I expect. Now, I say you're being slightly slack. I'm being a bit harsh there. It's not an unreasonable thing to do this, though in the real world, big post house like an ILM, a Digital Domain, a Sony, and Animal Logic, they're going to do all this properly. They're going to calibrate everything and have everything run through. But if you're on a facility that's just going to do a couple of film shots and you're scratching your head as to how to approach it, your best option for getting the most amount of data and for getting the most sensible stuff for a pre-existing pipeline is to take your red footage out as 985 and exposure minus 2. And that there is a bunch of other stuff in this white paper, but that stuff on the sort of second last page buried in the middle of the out section is probably the most interesting thing. And it's so interesting because even in Red Alert, they've actually dropped even offering 985 as a little button. Now, it's still there, of course, in Red Cine and stuff, so it's completely valid to use it. But up until this point, not many people had used 985 because it just seemed to be completely out of whack. And it wasn't until Autodesk analyzed that they discovered that actually it's out of whack by almost exactly 2 exposure points.
So do we see a time when we don't even have to discuss this stuff?
Oh, yeah, sure. Because if, for example...
So. No if, offense, but if I hope so.
As I said at the outset, if the Linux version of the API had come out, then you would open the R3D files and Autodesk would automatically deal with all this for you, right? Because But we're not at that point yet. And until we're at that point, it's worth mentioning it. Here's the other thing that's worth mentioning, and I think it's a bit of a surprise to me, but as you know, with PhD, we do a lot of testing. One of the things we discovered in the earlier builds was that there was, well, I used to joke, between a third and a half a stop in the highlights that was not available, and you could get that back by, say, in Red Alert, you would drop the ISO from 320 to 200, and this would pull back your extra point, your extra highlight detail. We have images that show this really clear, like Venetian blinds, completely blown out. You drop the ISO a bit, and wow, there's detail in the highlights.
You can see there's blinds.
Just all changed. Mm. No longer true. So now, what was actually mathematically 0.4 of a stop is now no longer hidden. They've recalibrated it so that, in fact, all of the highlight information is there without having to drop the ISO.
And this is build 17, you mean, then?
Basically. Yep, so all the current stuff, the current release stuff, it's now fully there. That there is no, and I got that confirmed by Graham Natras, that it's now back so that all the, there is no sort of sneaky stuff that you can do to pull in extra highlight detail. They just give it to you right there in, say, Red Alert. Yeah,
and it looks it. It looks a lot better. It definitely rolls off and looks more like film. And it was that clipping before that in the earlier builds that looked that little bit more tapey, I think.
See, now you're talking at it from a creative point of view, which is brilliant that you're right, you know, you immediately picked that up. I was curious to find out it from a technical point of view, and so we did a lot of testing here and took images and dropped the ISO. Now, there is one exception. If you're shooting at a high ISO, this is a space on a 320. If you're shooting at 320, then yes, there is nothing there in the highlights. You can be in a situation that you're shooting, obviously, at like 1,000 ISO and changing the ISO values up the other way, that you're going to get clipping because obviously you're trying to see into the darks because that's what you're doing. And
and this is you making it, so the choice of the ISO is a purely...
But at 320, they're right there and say, and in the histograms, if you bring them up, you think you might be seeing this. No, you're not. It's actually now, out of on the latest builds, all the highlight information is there. Now, you might want to drop it a little bit in the ISO to, say, 200 or 250, go right ahead, knock yourself out, not going to do any harm, but it's just not that you're getting back what you used to get back, which, as I say, mathematically 0.4 of a stop, we discovered. So that's, if you are somebody that follows us at FX Guide, you would have heard that earlier trick. It was a huge difference to me personally in some of the shots we were working on, so I found it to be a really important thing. Mm. But it's just been... change, which we wanted to also flag it, because if you're a regular listener, we want you to know that that is no longer a valid thing.
Yeah, and just so regardless of all of that chat, the main thing for me has been that the later builds have basically made Red look like film, and that makes it easier to sell in as a format, and it's a win-win really for everybody. It's a pity that a lot of this, it's hindsight is a wonderful thing. It would have been great to have all of this back-end stuff sorted out, which would never happen, of course. But the more we could have sorted out the the workflows before or as the camera was sort of coming into the market, it would have been better, because it's that first sort of foray where you really, where everybody really wants the camera to fit in with the way it works. The more it has to sort of have new workflows and new sort of thoughts and new extra processes, and then with all of those extra gotchas along the way, the more it makes it harder to get it in the door as a format, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's all coming and changing by the sound of it.
Now let's move now to our, instead of our Red Room, we're going to do mini Red Rooms by actually answering some of your questions. We get quite a lot of email here, and we try and explicitly or implicitly cover some of the things that you guys ask for.
Definitely.
But we've got a few, and we wanted to, you know, thank you guys for sending in, as we do, and we thought we'd answer a couple of the questions that we've been thrown. So the first one is from Kim Nook, and Kim is writing in saying that he's in Korea, which is great. So if you're listening to this, Kim, thanks so much. And he has a question here. He's shooting with Red Cine in the camera and using Red Space and Rec 709 for HD output, and he's specifically aimed at an HD output. But he's a bit of difficulty in working out some of the onset monitoring stuff, but also he has a question about the Red Space. And this is something that's come up a lot, so I'm going to take this as a one for me and say this is a very common question, which is, I don't quite understand what's going on with the Red Space and with Rec 709, and should I just be in Rec 709 if I'm going for Rec 709, and, you know, why even bother with Red Space? Well, there's a couple of points. Firstly, Red Space is pretty much very much equivalent to Rec 709 if we're talking about the there are two options. There's one is the color space you're working in, and the second is the gamma space that you're working in. Color space, gamma space. Color space is moving from the native lens to a sensible set of colors, which requires some matrixing, which is what the matrix button is there, and that happens at every camera. So Genesis, whatever, it's going to do matrixing to get to a color space. It's just that instead of defaulting to Rec 709, which may be not what you want for, say, doing feature film work, they have the slightly improved version of Red Space. Does it matter which of these two color spaces I go to? No, they're very, very equivalent. Then there's the gamma space that I'm working in. What is the gamma curve? What does it look like? If I'm outputting to film, I don't want to put video gammas in, so I would maybe use a log space. If I'm going out to video, I could choose one of the two, being Rec 709 or Red Space. Which gamma do I want, and is one illegal or the other? Well, I should tell you, at the high end, there's about 0.1 difference between the two. So as a rule of thumb, you could use either.
Right. Which is the issue for him, is that, but sounds like, is that if he puts it on one, the client prefers the other. It's all about what's being dictated to him on set by the on-set monitoring. It sounds like he's saying the clients are saying, I like Red Space much better, and it's forcing me to keep the Red Space gamma for transcoding.
It's not a problem because if you like looking at the picture using Red Space, if you're looking at it on an HD monitor, then what you see is what you get. If you're looking at it now on a broadcast monitor and you like the look of the pictures, if you're in Red Space, you're not doing anything wrong. You're now checking out your Red Space images on a Rec 709 monitor, but that's fine. If you like that look, put it to air, not a problem. If, however, you have used Rec 709 on set and you want to use Rec 709 in post so that the client is seeing the same images, well, that makes sense also. But as a rule of thumb, it's like thinking of Rec 709 as being the video standard, and there's another option, a slightly better red option that wasn't, you know, preordained by the SMPTE organization, a bunch of white guys in White Plains kind of years ago. And so that's just Red's idea of a slightly better version. Now, it's almost down to personal preference. To use a horrendous analogy, it's like on some TVs you'll have, you know, the dynamic look and the soft look and the normal look. Yeah. But it's not that. But it's, so whichever those prefer, I've got some personal tastes and we'll discuss that in an upcoming episode. And we go into this in enormous depth this week, actually, in FXPHD. But this is something that is a rule of thumb. You can go in either. And if you want to go and be working in Rec 709 and there's some really precise reason, like label colors on products, by all means hit Rec 709 earlier rather than later and remain consistent. But if you're liking what you're seeing in red, but just don't confuse those two things, the color space that I'm converting into and then the gamma space that I'm working to for my output, in which case video is going to give me only two options, realistically speaking.
Okay. But I mean, obviously, whatever gamma you set the camera to, in a way, you're lighting to that. You know, if it makes things look a little bit more blown out, then you put more lights in there, or you take lights away, and you're sort of lighting on set to whatever setting the camera is put to, you know, and that setting is being dictated by your clients in Video Village.
And if they like red space, yeah. Great, red space, go for it.
You just have to like what they like.
Yes. So we've had some other letters this week. A couple of people like Alan who've just sent in saying they like the podcast, think it's great, which is terrific, but didn't actually require complicated stuff. Had another email from Tom Gleason who actually wanted a discussion about how Red Cine works, and I'm going to say that we'll try and tackle that more in an upcoming week. He wanted a real kind of rundown of what's the key things to do with Red Cine. So Tom, we'll get to that. It's probably a bigger topic than we have time for right this second. Did you have something, Jason? You give me the look.
Was I?
I thought you were.
No.
No. We had a couple of people that that sent us emails actually saying that we shouldn't go over an hour. I'm now looking at the clock and realizing we're going over an hour. We've only managed to talk about one major...
I think we've done it again.
We've done it again, haven't we?
Definitely.
We've run out of time. Okay, well, maybe we'll do some more questions later.
Well, maybe we should expand that poll a little bit more. You know, for every person who says it's too long, there's other people that say no, and for everyone who says don't stuff with the rat holes, get to the, you know, make it a bit more formulaic, then there's five other people that say go the other way, we want rat holes. So look, regardless, we love the feedback, and we love your letters, and a lot of, as I said before, a lot of what we've talked about here on the show is been based on or guided and directed by people's requests. You know, the tripods and lots of things have been guided by you, the listener. So red@fxguide.com is the email address, or Twitter, either Mike or me. I'm sort of winding up before we need to, have we? No?
Go for it.
Going ahead. Okay. So, yes, I'm at Wingrove at Twitter, and or jasonwingrove.com for the website. And, yeah, red@fxguide.com for any feedback. We love it. Even if you just say, love the podcast, it's great to know that there are people out there listening. We appreciate it, really.
And I just want to say goodbye, but also flag, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, a surprise for next week. We have Ted on the show, exclusive one-on-one. We're going to sit down and discuss all the new revelations over Epic and Scarlet, give you the inside goss, and they'll try and put that out as close to, if not on the 13th, or maybe the night of the 13th as possible, otherwise the morning of the 14th. As you know, the 13th is the announcement date for the new Scarlet and Epic stuff, and we have Ted on the show next week to explain all of that to you. But that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Please keep your comments coming, as Jace said. And on behalf of myself and Jace, see you, Jace. See you guys. We'll talk to you next week. See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.